making them moist and comfortable again. So there's so many options.
So KY jelly doesn't cut it anymore?
Barbara!
You know what? For some people, KY jelly is just a ticket.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
We're so glad you tuned in.
First, a glimpse into the mysterious life and controversial death of American heiress Huguette Clark.
Then, an indoorsy kind of guy's reluctant journey into the dog park subculture.
Next, 10 great college towns to retire to. Which ones made the list?
Plus, painful sex after menopause. We'll talk solutions.
And we'll shoot the breeze with the babe's decorator turned HDTV star. When heiress Huguette Clark died in 2011 at the age of 104, she left behind a fortune estimated at $300 million. Despite her great wealth, she was a recluse, shunning the limelight for the last half century of her life. And for the final 20, she lived in modest rooms at Beth Israel Hospital in New York City, surrounded by a circle of very well-paid attendants. The strange thing is, she was perfectly healthy.
Huguette Clark's mysterious life and scandalous death is the subject of the new book, The Phantom of Fifth Avenue. The author, Meryl Gordon, is an award-winning journalist and regular contributor to Vanity Fair. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Meryl, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, I'm delighted you're interested in this strange saga.
It sure is.
Several years of my life.
Well, Huguette Clark was born into great wealth at the beginning of the 20th century. So where did all this wealth come from?
Her father was very much William Andrews Clark, a self-made man. He was the son of a farmer, but he did have more of an education than many of his time. And he initially made money mining for silver, and then he became a merchant. He supplied mining camps. He became a banker, and then he managed to buy up some claims in copper mines and made a fortune as a copper miner. And he was said to be the second richest man in America after John D. Rockefeller.
Wow.
So can you describe her childhood? Did she have a happy one?
She had a complicated childhood. Her father was married twice, and Huguette is the daughter of her father's second wife. He had four children who survived to adulthood from his first wife. And when his first wife died of typhoid fever, he met this lovely young 15-year-old. There was a 39-year age difference, and for many years, Anna LaChapelle was his ward. He sent her to boarding school. He sent her to Paris, and then she became pregnant and gave birth to a daughter named Andre. At that point, William Andrews Clark had gotten himself elected Senate, and he didn't want to tell the world. He had this lovely young girlfriend and daughter, and eventually he decided he wanted to go public, so he announced he had been secretly married, which, as you can imagine, the newspapers of that era went a little bit crazy about the old senator and the young girlfriend slash wife. And Huguette was their second child, and she was born in Paris. And her early years, by all accounts and information I was able to dig up, she led a very sheltered life. She and her sister lived in France for the first pretty much 5 or 6 years of her life, and then they ended up, her father built the largest house in New York. It had 121 rooms on Fifth Avenue, and they were part-time. They were part-time in France until World War I, at which point they fled France and lived in New York full-time. And the great sadness of Huguette's life was her sister Andre died of meningitis. It was very, very fast. And suddenly, there she was, 13 years old, rattling around this 121-room mansion by herself with her parents. And that was a big turning point for her.
And then we understand that her dad also died when she was only 18, leaving her a vast fortune. So how much was she worth at that point?
It's always hard to go back and look, try to figure out the calculations, but at least at that point they were saying $50 million. And $50 million in 1925 was a lot of money. And she naturally was the deb of the season. As you can imagine, she was extremely eligible. And there was a lot of, one of the problems for Huguette was that her older half-sister from her father's first marriage was married many times. Her older half-brothers were married many times. And William Andrews Clark was very protective of Huguette. You know, she was young and she was naive. So when she was young, he spent a lot of time saying to her, no one's going to love you for yourself. They're going to love you for your money. And while he meant well, that's a pretty crippling sentiment. She did marry once. She was married very briefly to a William Gower. His father had been, you guess, father's accountant, so there was sort of a family connection. There are a lot of suggestions that he may have married her for her money. She settled $1 million on him shortly after they wed, and she later told people that the wedding night was a disaster. She didn't know about sex and didn't much like it. They separated after 9 months and ended up divorcing. She never remarried. The interesting thing, there was a fight over who gets money, and after the lawsuit was settled, I was allowed access to 75 boxes of documents that were taken out of her apartment. And one of the interesting surprises were there were letters from her ex-husband. They became friendly again, 30, 40 years later, and they wrote to each other. So it was kind of a surprising part. But there were, Huguette had written a diary after her sister died, was in there. There were letters she wrote to friends. They also, this is a family that kept every receipt. So you, this is a woman who enjoyed her money in her early years. She was out buying Saisons and Degas and Renoirs. She was such a regular customer at the jewelry stores, Cartier, that she had her own special salesman. You know, even right after the stock market crash, she was still out there spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on trinkets.
And, Meryl, whatever happened to Huguette's mother? Was she in the picture at that point?
Huguette and her mother became very close, and right after Huguette's father died, the two of them moved into an apartment at 907 Fifth Avenue, just a couple of blocks away. And at one point, they started out on one floor, and then they rented another floor, the 8th floor and the 12th floor. And they essentially lived in the same building for the rest of their lives. They traveled together the rest of Huguette's mother's life. Her mother died in 1963. And even before then, there began to be stories that the women weren't going out very much, that a lot of the, you know, sometimes trauma happens early in life and then it comes back and nails you later on. And her mother became very germphobic, remembering how she had lost her first child, Andre, to meningitis. So there was a lot of, you know, buying, not just buying two seats at the opera, but buying the whole box to keep people away from germs. And after Huguette's mother died, she still was very close to her mother's sister who lived in New York. But once she died a couple years later, Huguette literally stopped leaving the house. And not only did she stop leaving the house, but she wouldn't let people come visit her. I mean, it really was weird. She had decorators who were, you know, and craftsmen who were working on improving the apartments, but she would talk to them through the door. There was a period where she, when some of the maids and staff retired, or while she would hire new people, some of them she never met. She would be in different rooms with her. She had 42 rooms. She had a lot of space. I mean, I, mind you, would be claustrophobic if I never left the house. But she may not have, we don't know quite when she stopped leaving. The last time any family members of her, descendants of her father's first family saw her was in 1968. And she went to the hospital in 1991. That's a lot of time in an apartment.
Our guest is Meryl Gordon, author of Phantom of Fifth Avenue, a biography about the reclusive American heiress Huguette Clark. You're listening to The Two Boomer Babes. I'm Kathy Bernard, and my co-host is Barbara Klein. You can listen to the show anytime on iHeartRadio.com or the iHeartRadio app. Now back to our conversation with author Meryl Gordon. In 1991, Huguette had a bout with skin cancer, which, as you say, forced her out of seclusion into the hospital in New York City. Now, this is where it gets even stranger. So how long did she end up staying in the hospital?
Well, she could have left after a couple months. It was a severe case of skin cancer. But she stayed in the hospital for 20 years. And there are still legal battles being fought over her hospital stay. But essentially, when they told her she could go home, she said, I don't want to go home, because after all of those years alone, suddenly she was in the hospital. People were being very, very nice to her. Now, of course, they were being very nice because they realized she was very wealthy. But suddenly she had people who paid attention to her and were very nice to her. So she decided that she wanted to stay. And
despite the fact that she was healthy, right?
Yeah, and I mean, the amazing thing is, you know, she stayed in a small hospital room. It wasn't some, you know, large suite. And she wore a hospital gown. She had, you know, millions of dollars of jewels at home that were later sold at auction. It's a pink diamond that went for $15 million. But it was all in the safe deposit box. She wore a hospital gown and stayed in her room.
And her hospital costs must have been staggering at that point.
It was more than $1 million a year, but she was also paying for round-the-clock private nurses. And the interesting thing is, she wasn't sick. She didn't need people around the clock, but she liked having the companionship, and she didn't want to have to, you know, she wanted people she knew every single day. Which brings me to her chief nurse, Hadassah Perry. Hadassah is probably the highest-paid nurse in the world. Hadassah began as an hourly employee. She's Filipino, married to an Israeli cab driver, and this was initially a part-time job. And Huguette really liked her, and Hadassah had a flood in her very small apartment. She had three children, and she told Huguette, "Oh, I had a flood," and Huguette said, "Well, you know, you should buy a new house. I'll help you." And that was the beginning of Huguette giving her an enormous, I mean, she gave her ultimately $31 million, which is pretty astonishing. Hadassah also made a really difficult choice. Huguette liked her so much, she asked her to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And this is a woman with three young children at that point. And Hadassah made the decision that for the financial security of her family, that she would do it. And she did it for 15 or 16 of the 20 years Huguette was in the hospital. She eventually cut back to more normal hours. But one of the more heartbreaking things, Hadassah's children were interviewed as part of this legal battle, and they burst into tears saying they never had a mother, that their mother was never around because she was always with Mrs. Clark.
Well, Meryl, you write also that the hospital aggressively campaigned for very large sums of money from Huguette, you know, in exchange for allowing her to remain in the hospital, even though, as you say, she was perfectly healthy. So do you have any idea how much she actually gave to Beth Israel Hospital?
Among other things, she gave them a Monet painting that was sold at auction for $3.5 million. She also gave a lot of money to her doctors directly into their pockets. And you know, most hospitals have rules against taking money from patients, and she was giving people, you know, million-dollar checks. And, you know, it's a complicated thing because obviously every hospital has a development department, and they look to their wealthy patients for donations. But with Huguette, they were incessant. I mean, the hospital had to turn over their email records as part of this lawsuit, and you really could see them pressuring her, visiting her, you know, shouldn't you make a will, you know, the equivalent, shouldn't you leave us money in the will? At one point, they even asked her when they were about to close down the particular hospital she was in to merge with another, they asked her, did she want to buy the hospital for over $100 million, which, you know, that's going a little far, don't you think?
Yeah. You brought up the wills. There were multiple wills, apparently. Where there were two of them that she actually signed?
What initially happened was when Huguette was getting her divorce, she wrote a will leaving everything to her mother. And then her mother died in 1963, and she refused to write another will. And for years and years, for decades, she was getting letters from her lawyer saying, if you don't do something, this money will go to the descendants of your four half-siblings. Huguette did not particularly like them. She wasn't particularly close to them. But literally, up until 2005, that money would have gone to them. In 2005, Huguette came down with pneumonia, and she had promised Hadassah $5 million, which she had not given her. She'd already given her $10 million and didn't. It was from the sale of a painting. And Hadassah really wanted her money and talked to Huguette's lawyer. So Huguette first wrote a new will that simply, she had put a Connecticut property up for sale, and her new will said that if the property wasn't sold before she died, that she wanted to guarantee that Hadassah would get $5 million. And then it left all the other provisions in place that would have, by default, her distant relatives would have gotten the money. Then, 5-6 weeks later, Huguette wrote an entirely new will, and she cut out all of her relatives. She set up her California estate as a artist retreat. She gave Hadassah 60% of the residue. She also left money to her goddaughter, Wanda, who she was very close to, and some top employees. as you can imagine, the family looking at the dates of the wills, and there were some questions about the initial signing ceremony with the second will, they challenged the will. And after several years and $40 million in legal fees, the family won a very large settlement.
So what happened with Hadassah? Was she able to keep her share?
Hadassah was forced to give back $5 million of the $31 million, but she was allowed to keep the rest of it. And there was also, initially, the public administrator's office had sued Hadassah for all of the money back, but under the settlement, she got to keep, as I said, $25 million.
And how is Hadassah doing today?
She showed up in court for when they thought there might actually be a trial, and she was very well dressed and looked quite cheerful. And I, for a long time, she was seen on a regular basis visiting Huguette's grave, which I thought was really touching. I don't know if she's still going. I have not been myself lately, so I don't know.
Now, were any of the doctors left money, or are the other nurses left money in the will?
One of the nurses, who Geraldine, who was the night nurse, was not left money in the will. She then sued, saying she'd been promised money. And now there is a legal fight between Huguette's estate and the hospital and the doctors and this nurse Geraldine trying to get the money back.
Meryl Gordon, author of The Phantom of Fifth Avenue, thanks so much for sharing Huguette Clark's fascinating story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Matthew Gilbert always considered himself an indoor kind of guy, joined at the hip with his TV and digital gadgets. After all, he's the longtime television critic for the Boston Globe. But Matthew's perception changed when he became the owner of an adorable yellow lab named Toby, and they started visiting the neighborhood dog park a lot.
Matthew chronicles his reluctant journey into the dog park subculture and his transformation into, quote, one of those dog people in his first book called Off the Leash. Welcome, Matthew.
Great to be with you.
So you readily admit that you were a homebody, kind of an introvert, and not really an outdoorsy person. So how did you and your beloved dog, Toby, find your way to the dog park?
It's funny because I guess it's a cliche at this point, but, you know, they say you get the dog you need and not necessarily the dog you want. And that was definitely the case with me and Toby. He, you know, was as social and playful as I wasn't. And he, you know, he needed to exercise. He needed to socialize. And I had to take him somewhere. So I started taking him to the park, and as I watched his joy and in playing there and being among his people, I realized I had to keep taking him there. And the more I went and the more he pulled me there, the more I sort of fell in with it and ultimately fell in love with it.
We love it that you say that he was among his people.
Right, exactly. You know, sometimes dog owners will say, well, why should I bring my dog to the park? He just sits there. But, you know, I do think they like to be among their own, even if it's just to be seen by them and to see them.
Right. And it sounds like you were kind of among your own, too, Matthew, because, you know, you talk about the surprisingly wonderful rewards of community for canines and for humans. So tell us about that for you.
Oh, boy. I just feel like places like the dog park are really special, especially special in today's world, you know, where we're all kind of attached to our own digital leashes. I mean, yes, I'm a TV critic, so I spend, you know, an inordinate amount of time in front of screens. But we all do at this point. And I think it's great when we find places where we can kind of give up the phone for a little while and mix with real people. And there's something unique about the dog park in that, well, for one thing, it attracts all different kinds of people from all different age groups and walks of life. I mean, I've met people I would never have, you know, come into contact with at the park. And then when you're with them, even if you don't seem to have anything in common, you find that you do, you know, that your love of dogs kind of creates this common ground. And I mean, I have some really intimate connections with people at the dog park because I see them, you know, every day almost. I mean, it's a nice mixture of intimacy and anonymity, because just as you kind of know them and, you know, have these great conversations about life and death and parenting and all kinds of things, you often don't even know their last names or where they live. So it's this really kind of nice social community building spot.
Well, the culture within the dog park, is there actually a hierarchy of dog owners as well as dogs themselves?
Yes.
So tell us about that.
There's a hierarchy, but it's quite different from the hierarchy in the world outside. You know, your job and your salary and the size of your house don't really matter once you kind of step into the dog park. What matters there and what establishes your place in the park hierarchy is, you know, your love of dogs. It's also whether or not you're respectful of other dog owners, whether you pick up your poop or your dog's poop, whether you know how to have a conversation. I mean, those things seem to be the currency in a dog park. So I love that. I love that it's its own kind of world with its subculture, with its own structures and rituals.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour, and we're speaking with Matthew Gilbert, author and TV critic for the Boston Globe, about his reluctant journey into the dog park subculture. His book is called Off the Leash. Okay, well, Matthew, you also say that the dog park has its tense moments as well, like when dogs are maybe fighting or stealing each other's toys. Do the owners get involved in all this?
Oh, absolutely.
In the ruckus?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing that you realize about the dog park pretty quickly is it's as much about the owners as it is about the dogs. And, you know, we go off leash too. And sometimes that can be, you know, we can get a little out of control. I mean, to me, I wrote it as a kind of celebration of the dog park culture that's kind of growing, you know, every year in this country. But there are some villains. And they tend to be the owners of aggressive dogs who don't control their dogs. You know, nobody wants an aggressive dog. So, you know, but if you happen to get one, and that's the sort of challenge that you're faced with in your connection with your dog, you need to deal with it. You need to own it. You can still come to the park, but you need to be very vigilant. Maybe leash your dog if you see that there are possible triggers around, you know. So those moments can be very ugly between owners.
Are any dogs ever sort of banished from the park?
Yes. I mean, there is a sense of, or Billy Jacks, forgive me. There is a sense that if someone, you know, really refuses to own their dog's bad behavior and won't work with other people to, you know, because I think dog park people are usually kind of willing to work with you and help you if you show a desire to, you know, make things right. But I have seen people sort of get unofficially banished from a park for never being willing to really take control.
Well, Matthew, have you learned anything about yourself after hanging around the dog park for a while? I mean, are you a changed kind of guy?
Well, that's been the great thing. You know, I'm 56. And this all happened to me about 10 years ago. And I think in this age group, or, you know, in my age group, people tend to feel like, you know, you are who you are at this point, and, you know, you're really not going to change, and that's okay. And so it's been really lovely to sort of change. And I am a changed kind of guy. I mean, I feel much more social, much more open to spontaneous social interaction. I'm a passionate dog lover now, and I would never live without a dog again. So, you know, I feel as though my life has changed significantly, and I'm really happy that I was able to be open to that.
So do you feel that dogs really do bring out the best in us mere mortals? Or they can bring out the best, put it that way?
I do. I really do. I mean, I think the relationship between a dog and an owner can be very interesting in a lot of ways. I mean, for me, it was challenging at first, you know, to have this dog that really required socialization and, you know, was not going to be happy unless he got to play with other dogs. You know, so he challenged me in a way that I needed to be challenged. And I think that a lot of relationships between dogs and owners are like that. And so I do think they make us better in a way. I think they push us just as much as, you know, we pull them or something.
Well, it's like an ongoing group therapy session, I suppose.
Exactly. I really feel that way. And I mean that as a compliment.
And it's free.
It's healing and it's free, more or less.
They bring so much joy. I just know my two little pooches, they can't wait to see me when I get home. I'm always so excited.
It's so great. I mean, it's such a lovely, lovely thing. It really is. And I think, you know, a lot more people are really discovering that. I mean, the numbers of households with dogs is just skyrocketing.
Matthew Gilbert, author and TV critic for the Boston Globe and now dog lover, thanks so much for sharing your great story with the Two Boomer Babes.
Great being with you guys.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Up next, 10 great college towns to retire to. Stay tuned and find out which ones made the list.
We know that Florida and Arizona are popular retirement destinations. But according to our next guest, boomers looking for a fabulous spot to relocate should consider a college town. Why? There are intellectual and cultural opportunities galore on college campuses. Think concerts, free classes, and season tickets to sporting events. And the icing on the cake? Many are located in tax-friendly states.
Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine is out with its latest list of the 10 great college towns to retire to. Here to tell us which places made the cut and why is senior editor Sandra Black. Welcome, Sandra.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk first about why it's so great to retire to a college town. So what's the upside?
There's a lot of upsides. And as you mentioned, one is sort of intellectual engagement. All of the towns we profiled, universities based there, offer a wealth of education for seniors. They offer discounted tuition or free tuition or special learning institutes for seniors. And we've learned so much about how keeping your brain active can really ward off dementia and Alzheimer's. So I think this is a huge benefit for people to be able to participate in that. Plus, they get to be around young people, which I think is also very energizing. That, to me, was a big criteria, just the fact that you can stay so intellectually engaged in all of these communities.
Sure. And then did you consider weather and cost of living and what other things went
into
the
list? We looked at, well, as I said, we sort of screened for tax friendliness, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is why a lot of really great East Coast college towns did not make our list. And same with California. And I heard from a lot of people who were kind of annoyed by that. But for the purposes of this, we looked at tax friendliness. And we also looked at the cost of living. All of the cities on our list are relatively small towns. They're not big cities. But they have big city amenities. So you get the benefits of low cost of living, low housing costs, but so many of the advantages that you would give up if you moved to a small town that didn't have a big college in it.
Now, Sandra, you mentioned seniors, quote unquote, who can take advantage of all these incredible benefits. Is there an age cutoff?
In general, it's 60 and over. Some are younger, some skew a little older, but 60, 62, 65 tends to be where the very special discounts and targeted programs. But I think even if you moved to one of these college towns and you were younger, you would still have plenty of opportunities to audit classes or take special courses or attend lectures. at low or no cost.
And stress-free, because you don't have to take the final exam.
That's right, unless you want to.
Well, let's get to the list. At the very top is University of Mississippi in Oxford. What made it such a great place?
Well, Oxford is a small town, but it's attached to, obviously, University of Mississippi. And what really makes Oxford very attractive is that I think of it as a retirement destination for English majors or people who love books. It's the home of Faulkner. It's got a very popular bookstore called Square Books that holds author readings and all kinds of events. It's got a beautiful public square, and it's got great, great food. I've heard it compared to New Orleans, Austin, but a lot less expensive.
Ooh, that's important.
Ooh. Yeah, definitely. And it's just a beautiful place, obviously Mississippi, so you're going to have hot summers but mild winters. And Mississippi is very tax-friendly, particularly for retirees. So I think it's just got a lot of very appealing features for somebody who loves books.
Okay, now University of Michigan in Ann Arbor also made the list, which is absolutely a fabulous place. It's beautiful. But, you know, you really got to like winter.
You do. Although one thing I note in the story is that, and if you've been there, you know this, you can get to the airport pretty quickly from Ann Arbor. It's about a 25.
You can escape.
Yeah. So I think that the folks that I talk to, a lot of them do retreat to warmer places in the wintertime, because certainly Michigan winters are tough. But one thing I really liked about Ann Arbor, well, two things. One is they had some really fascinating and interesting programs for seniors, and their health care is off the charts. People travel from all over the world to get health care at the University of Michigan Health Centers, and it would be right there for you if you live there.
Wow. Well, another place that hit the list was Boise State University, which, talk about, again, brutal winters, but I guess you can ski. There are skiing opportunities there. But Boise, Idaho, so what put that school on the list?
Well, actually, they told me the winters aren't that bad, although maybe that's relevant to, relative to them.
Yeah, they're crossing their fingers.
This would be my pick for the outdoorsy seniors. And, you know, you're right up against the mountains. It's absolutely beautiful. Mm. There's walking paths, running paths, you know, just a ton of outdoor activities. And even though Boise is kind of, you think of us out in the middle of nowhere, it's got a really cosmopolitan vibe. It's very interesting. It's got the largest Basque community in the United States. And they have Basque restaurants. And that's because the sheep herders came over from the Basque country years ago, and their relatives are still there. Ooh. Obviously, Boise State has a very active sports schedule for people who love football and basketball. And it has a minor league baseball team. And they have good health care there, too.
Sounds fabulous.
I'm getting ready to move.
Okay, so let's quickly go over some of the other college towns that made the list. Now, we noticed University of Virginia in Charlottesville, which is gorgeous, my daughter's alma mater. But isn't that rather expensive, too?
It is relative to some of these other towns. Again, it's a matter of scale. I think housing costs there are higher than, say, they are in Oxford. But if you are someone who is relocating from New York or Washington, D.C., I think you would find Charlottesville pretty affordable.
Really? Okay, so tell us about a few of the other places that made the list.
As you mentioned, Lexington, home of University of Kentucky, made our list. Very pleasant, small town, great place for horse lovers. One place that really appealed to me, and I think appealed to a lot of people, is Asheville. Asheville doesn't have as big a university. UNC Asheville is there. But it's beautiful, great health care, and just a lot of very active young people, old people sort of mixing for drum circles and all kinds of things going on. I think if you were sort of an older hippie, you would love Asheville.
We could hike in the mountains, too.
That's right. And Asheville, in terms of climate, Asheville's probably the friendliest one on our list.
They have a great art scene, too.
Yeah, exactly. Very great art scene. And another one, great music scene, is Athens, Georgia. Anybody who is an REM fan probably knows that they are from Athens. They have a lot of clubs with great local music. I interviewed a couple there who say they're busier than they've ever been. They both take and teach classes. They say there's tons of great restaurants. They're out every night.
And then State College, too.
State College, Pennsylvania. Now, that one probably will surprise people because if they've been there, they know it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. But it's beautiful. It's affordable. And it has a ton of interesting programs for seniors. And the people I talk to, it tends to attract people who went there. You know, all of these towns are attractive for retirees who want to retire to their alma mater. I think people have very strong ties to State College and love the fact they could go to games.
I know this is a tough question. Do you have one favorite?
Well, I am a English major. So, yeah, I was definitely leaning towards Oxford. I just think the idea of being able to mingle with all those famous authors and go to the bookstore and wander around the square and read Faulkner, that would really appeal to me.
Sandra Block, senior editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine, thanks so much for sharing the list with the two Boomer Babes.
Just turn on the television and we're bombarded with ads touting a gazillion pills for erectile dysfunction. We babes have seen those ads so many times, we can practically recite them verbatim.
So what about equal time for women's sexual health issues as we grow older? For example, a common problem after menopause is painful sex. Some women seem reluctant to go there, even with their doctors. As a result, they suffer in silence. Joining us to get this topic out in the open is Dr. Susan Kellogg-Spott, a sexual health expert and OBGYN professor at Drexel University in Philadelphia. So, doctor, how common is painful sex after menopause?
Well, actually, it's much more common than you'd anticipate. About 20 to 45% of midlife women say that they're having difficulty with dryness, burning, itching, or just frank pain with intercourse, either with penetration or further into the intercourse act, so that it becomes actually prohibitive and they can't have to stop having intercourse altogether.
So do they basically go into sexual retirement? What a bummer.
Yeah, kind of. And, you know, they really don't feel like they should. When we look at today's midlife women, we're really not seeing the menopause of their mothers or their grandmothers, when people were kind of taking this and saying, well, I guess it's time to start sleeping in separate beds, and we had a lot of good years together. Women now are saying, no way, absolutely not. You know, I don't know what I can do about this, but I'm going to do something about it. And they're very dissatisfied with the pain that they're experiencing, but they don't always know what to do.
So what do you do? Are there any treatments for this?
Great. Well, you know what? There's so many treatments. And that's probably what's really frustrating. About when we talk about the changes associated with something called vulvovaginal atrophy, or newly renamed genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And that's simply fancy words that talk about the changes in the tissue and the glands and the moisture in the genital tissues of women after menopause. When we talk about those, 4 of 10 suffer with these symptoms and have never had a discussion with their healthcare provider. And 62% of women in surveys, when told about the symptoms of the genital symptoms of menopause, say, oh, I didn't know those had to do with menopause. I thought I had a yeast infection or something. They didn't know what's going on. Well, the truth of the matter is most of the symptoms are caused by lack of hormones in the genital region. And there's many treatments ranging from over-the-counter treatments like lubricants and moisturizers. And then there's soothing creams that are also now over-the-counter. There's local estrogen. There's systemic estrogen. And now there's another option, you've probably seen it on the media, called Oxyna, that is a non-estrogen, that a pill a woman takes every day, a non-estrogen, but actually addresses these tissues and brings them, revitalizes them, making them moist and comfortable again. So there's so many options.
So KY jelly doesn't cut it anymore?
Barbara!
You know what? For some people, KY jelly is just the ticket for those early days of menopause or the perimenopause, that 45th birthday or that 46th birthday. But, you know, the further a woman goes into the menopause, maybe by her 54th or 55th birthday, lubricants and moisturizers aren't always enough. They just, no matter how much they put on, they're still burning or itching or feeling really raw afterwards.
You also talk about that some of these treatments contain hormones. So what are the side effects of those?
I think we've established the fact that genital tissues really have an affinity or a liking for at least a little bit of estrogen in the tissues to make them moist and elastic. And some of the tissues actually have testosterone receptors as well, interestingly. But when they don't have them, they feel, again, much more dry and uncomfortable. People think sometimes of estrogen as an all-or-nothing proposition, like I'm on estrogen, i.e. they take it in patch form or pill form, and they have it going through every single tissue in their body, or I'm not taking estrogen, meaning I'm not taking any at all. Well, there's a very nice middle ground called local estrogen therapy, which is local therapy for local tissues. A little tiny bit of cream, a tiny little bit of a little pill that goes in the vagina rather than in the mouth, or maybe even a ring that goes in the vagina, and time releases a tiny, tiny amount of estrogen into these estrogen-sensitive tissues without the, quote, danger or the risk of systemic absorption, which is where you'd be in traditional hormone therapy that goes through the whole bloodstream. So in terms of risks, there's any risk any time a woman takes a hormone of any sort that she should talk over with her own doctor. But to minimize risk, one would use local applied estrogen in some form rather than systemic. And then to minimize risk even more, maybe she'd like to take a non-estrogen solution like Oxfina, where she has no exposure to estrogen at all, but that the tissues respond as though they have estrogen.
This is Barb and Kathy, and you're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour, and we're talking with sexual health expert Dr. Susan Kellogg-Spott about a common problem, painful sex after menopause, and what women can do about it. Well, doctor, are any of these treatments that you were just describing, are they covered by insurance?
Absolutely they are. And, you know, I think I'd like to talk a little bit about why more people don't know about them or the fact that they don't. You know, about one-third of women that experience these symptoms talk to their healthcare provider about it, but not everyone does. They feel like, well, this is just part of aging. This is what I get for, you know, having that 50th birthday or that 60th birthday. And the truth is, I would really like to do a shout out to the women listening and say, it's time to bring this up with your healthcare provider. Please do so. There's a grassroots movement all over the United States that's being championed by the Women's Health Foundation, a social media group, that, and also a women's health group that is asking women to get online and say, it's time to start talking about this with our healthcare providers. Please don't accept this, and please do bring it up. Sadly, sometimes healthcare providers don't bring it up because they think if the problem was bothering the woman, that she would be the first to make a statement about it. And in fact, with the women being silent and the healthcare providers being silent, no one's talking about this. And just like you said, every single day we're bombarded with ads for Viagra and Cialis. It's time that we got equal time, I think, for healthy sexuality after menopause. And women need to really champion that cause by speaking up and talking to their healthcare provider.
Well, doctor, what is the upside of this non-estrogen treatment?
Well, the upside is that, again, it binds to the tissues like the vagina and vulva and clitoris and labia and things that are very sexually sensitive and, let's be frank, feel good when they're functioning properly. And it binds to those areas, making the areas revitalized, thick, moist, supplying the pH of the vagina into a proper range so a woman feels more comfortable without the risk of the attendant risk of going on estrogen products.
So wouldn't
it
be
pretty revolutionary? It's only been out for just a little over a year, and it's pretty revolutionary, actually.
Oh, terrific. Okay, I was just thinking, it just seemed like that would be the way to go to avoid all of the downside of estrogen.
Well, it's certainly an option, and something, I'd like to really ask the listeners to think about talking to their doctors about. Sometimes doctors and other healthcare providers are a little bit hesitant to start a new treatment when it's its first year out, because they want to see how it's, you know, if there's any hidden side effects or anything that didn't come out in the studies that are going to show up in real use among users on, you know, all through America. Well, it's past its first birthday, and the data on the first year of use across the United States is very, very clean and very, very reassuring. And so it's time, even if someone's healthcare provider is not an early adopter of new medicine, it's not new anymore. Now it's been out for a year, so it's time to have that conversation.
Also, are there other medical conditions besides the ones that we've just addressed that may cause painful intercourse?
Oh, there's so many conditions that can cause painful intercourse. So let's just name a few. In the premenopausal time frame, women with chronic infections can have of the vagina can have painful intercourse. Women whose pelvic floor muscles, the muscles that line the vagina and they're around the rectum and also around the opening of the vagina, the same muscles that expand to let a baby out through the vagina, sometimes rather than being normal tone or loose tone, which we hear about all the time, are actually just the opposite. They're high tone, they're spasming and taut, so much so that they can't comfortably allow a woman to have an insertion of a, you know, a penis or even a finger in the vagina without horrible, horrible pain. That can affect actually women of premenopausal age and postmenopausal age, and that's pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. There's other inflammation that can happen at the little tiny mucin or mucus secreting glands at the opening of the vagina. If they become inflamed rather than do their job and secrete mucus, but instead they don't secrete mucus and become very dry and super inflamed, that condition is called vestibulodynia, and that can cause tremendous penetrative pain when a woman is attempting to have intercourse. That's just a few conditions or skin conditions where the skin is taut and cracks and bleeds when a woman attempts to have intercourse. But again, if it's never brought up with a healthcare provider, we can't help people. There's answers to all of these things. And those of us that devote our medical practices to sexual medicine see them every single day.
And then finally, doctor, you say that the old adage, use it or lose it, you know, also applies to sex. So are you saying that basically the more sex we have, the less painful it will eventually become?
Well, if you think about any other muscle system or skin system in your body, if you work out your thighs or if you work out your shoulders or if you moisturize your face every day, it's going to stay more useful and more functional. Any of those systems will stay more useful and functional as you age. The vagina, vulva, pelvic floor muscles, no different at all. The more that they're exercised, used for pleasure, moisturized with either a non-estrogen or estrogen or the Osfina product, any of those things, if you keep the skin and the muscles in good shape, they will reward you by staying comfortable. And let's just face it, sexy as a woman ages. So I'm saying, yes, the more comfortable a woman has sex and the more regularly she has sex as she ages, the longer her genital area will stay functional.
Well, I say this kind of exercise sounds a lot more fun than going to the gym.
Indeed.
I guess more than our birthdays and anniversaries, right?
That's right.
Yeah, more than twice a year. Yeah, maybe three of his birthday too. And sometimes you just have to make up your mind. You know, and going to the gym, I don't love going to the gym every day, but sometimes I just make up my mind that I need to get there for my overall well-being. Sometimes women need to make up their mind that they need to kind of get in that sexual game, initiate sex play, or at least respond positively when someone else initiates it. Even if you don't exactly feel like it at the beginning, by the end of the scenario, as long as sex isn't uncomfortable, most women say, I'm really glad I did that. We should do that more often. I feel so much more connected with my partner, and I feel good about me, and I'm not ready to retire from sex yet. I'm just not. I'm still young, fit, and healthy, and I'm going to do this. Here's your pep talk for the day.
Great advice. Sexual health expert Dr. Susan Kellogg-Spott, thanks so much for bringing clarity to this issue.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You just might recognize our next guest. He's our go-to decorator for all seasons. Since we last spoke, Jamie Merida was discovered by HGTV. He's now a featured decorator for the series House Hunters Renovation. He's an award-winning international designer and owner of Bountiful Casual Elegance in Easton, Maryland. Jamie joins us to shoot the breeze about his soaring career. Welcome back, Jamie.
It's great to be back, ladies.
Great to have you. Well, Jamie, when did you first get that phone call from HGTV?
They actually didn't call me directly. They called the store. And I sort of kind of blew it off the first couple of times. I thought, oh, this must be advertising or something. And one of the ladies who's worked for me a long time finally came up and said, you know, I think this woman is really serious from California. You really probably should call her back.
So how did they even track you down? How did they know about you in the first place?
You know,
that everybody would know about you.
Of course.
A legend in my living room.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting in this the way that social media and all those things and apps on our phones and stuff work. There's an app for interior design called House, H-O-U-Z-Z. And it's a way for people like me can put our work out there and then people can look at the work and pull things that they like for themselves. Anyway, the producer from Los Angeles was responsible for finding people for this East Coast version, and they had done a casting call and hadn't really found enough people. So she sort of was given the job of finding people, and she went to House and saw how we ranked on House and saw our work and then read my bio and then had tracked me down that way.
So. That is so cool. Yeah. So did you have to audition or was it kind of a done deal?
No, I definitely had to audition because we chatted on the phone and she says, you know, just from the phone, you seem like your personality's upbeat and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, we need you to do a videotape. So I spent pretty much an afternoon in the shop with a camera guy and they had given me a sort of a list of questions that I needed to answer in a non-question and answer form. And we presented that to them and then sent it off to Los Angeles for them.
Very cool. So tell us about the premise of the show.
The premise is sort of like an extended version of House Hunters, if you all watch that on HGTV, where somebody, you watch them purchase a house. The first half of the show is basically the same premise. You know, in my case, with this first episode, it's a young couple who is looking for a house in downtown Baltimore. They select the house, and then at that point, I'm brought into the picture to help them do a lot of renovations on the property.
So was it an entire house makeover that you were doing?
It's funny. Each episode's going to vary. With the project, the first episode I did, we basically redid the first floor of a Baltimore row house. That was the scope of work, was sort of living room, dining room, kitchen.
And you have to keep within a certain budget?
Again, you know, when you do the show, HG contributes a certain amount of money. The couple contributes a certain amount of money. And, you know, the goal is to try to get all of that done, you know, within a very quick period of time and give a real high-end result.
So how did it turn out? I assume good, because you have your show.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, I think it turned out pretty fantastic. I think the couple was really thrilled. It really freshened up the row house, which desperately needed work, as you'll see when the episode airs with, you know, the before and after.
Wow, to have that vision, I think, is incredible. Well, this must have taken an enormous amount of time. I mean, how much time does it?
I think for me, who's not really done television before, I'm absolutely flabbergasted at how it happens. You know, like they say, it's like making sausage. It's not pretty to watch. But it's just incredibly time-consuming to get little snippets of television time, which I had been – was completely unaware of.
So, Jamie, when is the show slated to air?
The first episode I'm in airs September 13th, and I think it airs at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time is the first – you know, the first presentation, and then it'll run throughout the season.
So how many episodes are you going to be in, do you think?
Well, so far I've gotten the one. There's only like 12 episodes per season, and there were four in Baltimore, four in Connecticut, and then four in Boston. So, you know, hopefully when the season cycles around next year.
You'll be back.
I hope.
And would you love to do it again?
Oh, absolutely. It was a lot of fun.
So any other cool projects on the horizon that you've got?
You know, we're doing a lot of cool stuff. I mean, we're really fortunate at the shop that, you know, things have taken off and, you know, the designers and myself are getting to do a lot of fun things. I mean, I've done some houses with people who've got really cool taste in art. We've done a lot of, you know, American outsider art. I just did a whole house built around that, which is really kind of fun.
Is that like cowboys and...
No, outsider art is that kind
what is
of
that?
Like untrained artists who become famous, you know, who just like take up painting. Like Grandma Moses would be an example of outsider art. We're getting to do a lot more contemporary things, which is really fun for me because of where I'm located. It's been pretty traditional, but, you know, we keep getting more and more clients who are sort of more and more, you know, worldly in a sense.
And so that always freshens up your challenge.
Absolutely.
Your decorating challenge.
Well, this is so exciting. A TV personality in our midst.
Well, Jamie Merritt, a decorator and one of the stars of HGTV's House Hunters Renovation. It's always our pleasure to have you with us on the show.
Always great to be here with both of you. Thanks again.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.